Well, I think maybe what I ought to do is concentrate on technology first and a little bit about the future of education. And there's some very, very exciting things happening. It's so exciting that I get goosebumps when I read this stuff, because it's really, really going to do some fantastic things to education and for education and help teachers. And the more I get into it, the more I believe that. I'm not an educator, and I'm not, except that I had a Sunday school class once. As some of you know. And that's why I was there. I'm going to have another one this fall. And I'm not a technologist. I don't have, I'm not an engineer. And in my corporation, they call guys like me social scientists, which has always been a bad name until just recently. And then they finally said that the engineers have been making such a mess of things. Are there any engineers here? That's all right. That they're going to let social scientists try it for a while and see how we can mess it up.
What is a social scientist?
Oh, I don't know. No one bothered to tell me what that was, but I know it's not an engineer. But anyway, I've been messing around. Some of you that have been here for years know that I've been messing around in corrections for a long time. And I've done a lot of studies, and my background is primarily research and development. I've been running research and development organizations for a long time. And last year, I ran a project for the state legislature of Minnesota. We had a select task force of about 20 citizens, half of them legislators and half of them citizens. And we studied the future of corrections. We projected what was going to be happening in corrections in 1985. And sure enough, the major thread through the whole thing was education and the technology going along with it. Some of it was medical type stuff. There's a lot of interesting medical treatments coming along. But the basic stuff was helping people get their act together. Education of all kinds, not just literacy and the basic stuff at all. So I got into corrections, into education a lot there. And my basic assignment for a year, no, for 2 years, hasn't it been? Yeah, 2 years, has been to convert a lot of the training that we do within the corporation that I work for, which is Control Data Corporation, a computer corporation, to convert the education over to individualized and computer-based education. And so that's where I got involved with the new technology. And up until that point, I really hadn't been too much involved with computers other than the standard way of programming them and things like that. And so I come at this from a lot of different ways. But I don't have the bias, if there is such a thing, of an educator. And I'm sure there is. Everybody has their biases. And I don't have the biases of the engineers from the technology point of view. So maybe I have a perspective that would help many of you that are teachers and maybe some of you that are engineers. How many of you are in the teaching, the education business? Just let me see what I'm up against here. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know neat things about libraries. Super stuff. Wow. Really coming on. Oh, I got pages and pages of stuff I found today about libraries I didn't even know about. Library is going to be the core of everything. In fact, that's we could start there, but I won't do that. There are some very serious problems in education, though, and I want to relate those, because I just finished doing a study for the Department of Education in Minnesota, looking at the problems of education, and they're faced with just some crippling problems. First of all, and this is just for background, so that you know that this isn't all roses. It's a tough situation to be in. And I think the picture in Minnesota is probably typical throughout the United States. At least it is for secondary and elementary education. We did this study for the Commissioner of Education, and he's the chairman of all the commissioners. The commissioners of education of all the states have a big organization, and he is the new chairman of that. He took it with him in June, and gave it to the commissioners, and they're all critiquing it now, and he also gave it to the President's Advisory Council on Education. And everybody said, that's the way it is. They all agreed in every state. And one of the problems is economic. And the easiest way to look at it is, here's 1975, and here's 1985 up here. And here, costs are going up something like this. This is the way they're projected to go. And even the most conservative costs would be somewhere here. Revenues are here now. And they could very well come out here. So the problem then is, this is the costs, and here's the income here. And that discrepancy just isn't going to happen. Now, the reason that it can't happen is because it's so doggone big. In Minnesota alone, we're running at a $500 million deficit for the biennium. That means it's $250 million a year. We're spending that much more than we're taking in for education. And the monies available are becoming less and less. So that really makes it a problem. There's going to be a big crunch in education. Alongside of that is the growth of the teachers' unions. And I think you all know about that if you're in teachers. And they have become one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful force at the federal level and in the states too. So in this mess here, the most obvious thing is to reduce the numbers of teachers involved, because that's where 60 to 80% of the costs are. And that's what all state legislators, I think, we have a state legislature here, so I have to be careful what I say about that too. But they look at that right away. In my experience with them, they do. And of course, they can't control it because school boards control it. They can semi-control it by doing certain things. But it's really a mess. It really is a mess, because there isn't any solution that seems to fall out of it. And then there's the sociological trends. This is just education in secondary in Minnesota. We're just running that kind of a deficit there. In higher education, particularly with the small colleges, and I did a study on that this year too, they are really in deep weeds. They're in trouble financially because they're losing their student base. Numbers of students for the next few years are going to stay the same but begin to go down. Costs are going up astronomically, and the alumni, which have traditionally supported institutions like that, aren't paying. They just aren't coming up with the cash like they used to. So small colleges have really got it tough. And one of the most unique, one of the neatest ideas I heard was one that you told me about, Doris, the other day. In order to keep your costs down, you're bringing in retired professors and professionals and giving them an apartment and letting them do their thing. And that's really a great idea. Everybody wins in a situation
like that.
Yes,
another thing that helps balance the budget are these peripheral courses.
These
courses that we give not only at the college, but at Point Magoo and places, military installations,
right.
Places
there's
like that.
There's where you
that.
Go. In California, they're doing that.
So you see, we have around, we have over twice, between 2,000 and 3,000 students in those kind of courses, master's degree courses and graduate courses of various kinds, and for undergraduate too, for that matter. But
That's the best solution of all.
And we have between 1,650 something like that students,
sure.
Regular students on the campus. But here we've got almost three times that many in these other courses.
Yes. That's really going to be the salvation of a lot
and
of small schools.
And the cost of teaching, you see, the teaching cost is so much less because
sure.
Most of these people are moonlighting.
Sure.
For so much a course.
Right. I know that the California State College System is looking toward computer-based education and selling it to the corrections area and getting into that arena. That's a big arena. Well, so there are a lot of problems, and there are some real, very critical crises that politicians are going to lose their jobs over and things like that. In about 2 years, the crunch, I think, is going to hit about 77. At least I know for sure in Minnesota it is. South Dakota probably the same way. It's going to be tough. Now, there are different kinds of education. We think of it in, let me put this on the board if I can find my eraser. Yeah, here it is. Most of us think of education by what we're involved with. If you're in elementary, secondary, you're thinking about that. So I always start with adult continuing education or lifelong learning. That, I think, is, and many people believe, is going to be the largest thing going on in the next 10 years. It will get progressively larger and larger. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Then there's, of course, higher education. And then there's sort of in between vocational, industrial, the military spend an awful lot of money on education, as you can guess. And then there's secondary and elementary. And then something that I also think is going to grow a lot, and that's preschool. And at least we hope it will. And so that's one way of dividing them up. That's been easy for me to think about various kinds of education. And when I show you the technology and we talk about that, it impacts these areas in different ways. And so maybe we'll have time to refer to each one, or I'll pick out a special kind of thing that seems to work best in one area rather than another. Okay, how many of you that are involved in education have been involved with some sort of computer-based system? I know that we had one engineer, Rossing. He was going to be here. Is he here? No, he was involved a little bit in that. Anybody here been involved in computer-based education? Okay, well, I'll start from scratch a little bit then. First of all, There's a report by the Carnegie Foundation on technology and education, and they call what's happening to us now in the next 20 to 30 years the fourth revolution. A guy named Eric Ashby identified the four revolutions that have taken place in education. The first one, and this is really interesting stuff, occurred when societies began to differentiate adult roles and the task of educating the young, when it was shifted from parents to teachers and from the home to school. That was the first one. The second one was when, in some places, that was antedated by the first, was the adoption of the written word as a tool of education, by the written word. Prior to that, oral instruction prevailed, and it was only with reluctance that writing was permitted to coexist with the spoken word. It was a real trauma when written word came in to replace the oral tutorial stuff, which we've all forgotten, I guess. The third revolution was the invention of the printing press. And now the fourth revolution, in this guy's view, is the development in electronics, communications, radio, television, tape recorder, and the computer. So that's what the title of the Carnegie Foundation report was, the fourth revolution. That's the report I found that I had forgotten about. That's such a good report, I think. So let's talk a little bit about technology and what it means. First of all, the whole business of education, I think, is best characterized in the things that are happening to it in the term individualized. Individualization is taking over, apparently. Maybe I see it an awful lot because I have a narrow view, but I think that providing the student with an individualized path, a set of educational things that will meet their own needs, is really coming on, and it's becoming possible. In fact, it's rather interesting when you go back and look at the history of education. The Socratic method, which is the individualized method, I think, was originally used for thousands and thousands of years. Socrates, a tutorial, one-on-one, asking the student what he needs to know and giving it to him. That was around for almost forever, the whole history of our race, until just lately when we began to warehouse people and put them in the classrooms and start having what we now call traditional education, which isn't traditional at all. The old Socratic method is traditional. That's just very recent. What we have all experienced in the last few generations is not at all typical of what's happened. And so we seem to be going back to the old Socratic or the individualized approach. Unfortunately, it's very expensive to do that because we're trying to train everybody. When they applied the Socratic method, it was only to a select elite few. But in our society, and I don't mean just in the United States, but the world societies want to provide that kind of attention to everybody. And that's been very expensive, particularly when you have to use people to transmit the information. But let me go to individualized. And what are the various elements of this? First of all, that's the important word, I think. And I can't spell very well because I have a learning disability. And that's why. Yeah. That's what I say anyway when I spell this wrong. Tutorial and lecture. And then written. I'm sorry. That's the one that was that blew the minds of a lot of people several hundred years ago. And then multimedia, this is all multimedia. Visual and auditory. And then computer assisted. Okay. Now, over the way that things are shaping up in technology, in terms of the way that these methods are used, at least this is the bias I see. And I've just spent, just before I came out here, I spent a week traveling around the United States looking at the various installations that have the most progressive technical stuff, some of the stuff in the Air Force and some universities and some other private corporations. So I've had a look at the various methods that they use and the various techniques and the technical stuff. But the one thing that seems to be coming out is that the computer is being used more and more to manage the instructional process. And the way I view it is it's freeing the instructional person, the teacher, from all of these repetitive tasks and the task of having to retain all the knowledge in your head and deliver it, you know, from your head. It's freeing the teacher up to do the things that teachers like to do best and I think do best. And that is manage, get involved in tutorial sessions when a child has a problem. And computer-managed instructional systems, I haven't really worked with one yet. I'm implementing one when I get back. I started around August 1st within our corporation. But the characteristics are just magnificent if they ever work, and I think they do. Some have worked. Ohio State has a very good one for its medical school, I believe. And the ideal situation is where the computer tracks the progress of the student and works with the student as he or she goes along. And if a student gets into trouble, diagnosis very quickly occurs, and in the best of all situations, the computer would go to a resource library and bring in the material that would help the student, remedial material or whatever, you know, whatever he needs. Or in most systems today, they call the problem to the attention of the teacher, and the teacher does something and they go to work and solve the problem. So it's the management of the instructional process with a particular emphasis on the individual student's problems or challenges. I keep thinking about problems because I keep working with learning disabled kids. But for gifted kids, they have more of a problem, I think, than learning disabled kids, in the sense that they get bored because they can never move on at their own pace. If they're in a classroom, they've got to sit there and wait for the thing to get over with. They've already caught it all. And in these new systems, they can just zip ahead as fast as they want. And that brings about all kinds of cultural problems in our school system. I was talking to some people from Hamline University Hamline College, you know, I guess it's university, in St. Paul, where they had introduced individualized courses in psychology. And I think they go for 3 months in a quarter, and some kid finished the course off in 3 weeks. And they said, what do we do with him? He's just going to sit here. Well, he can't go home. He's got to stick around here. And so the cultural problems within institutions are going to be very difficult to deal with. What are we going to do about the kids that finish early? And there are a lot of laws that says that you do have to stay around. The FTC has certain rules about certain schools where you cannot leave even though you finished the course. You have to give them so many classroom hours. Well, I'm kind of drifting off to the side, but the instructional processes that I've been managing, and since I'm not an educator, I can't run them, but I manage them, are made up of all of these things. And for instance, when we build course material, when you take a traditional course material, which we do, you go through it and get it all lined up, somewhat like program instruction. You get it all lined up so that it makes sense and is sequential and it's branching. You can go off in different directions. And then somebody who's an expert in multimedia or an expert in the written word or the computer, they'll all work together as a team and select out that part of the material that's best presented by one of these different media so that they get mixed. To prevent boredom, if something's really great and as a lecture, they either have a lecturer do it or they put it on videotape so that someone can watch it whenever they want to. And so when you get done with a course, like I've built about 5 or 6 in the last year, you have a real neat mix of all of these things. We took our courses for managers and completely individualized them. At one time we had them all traditional classroom type of courses where people got a teacher got up and lectured and they gave them simulation games and they worked hard and things like that. And they usually sat around for 3 days. We brought managers in from all over the country and it cost us a lot of money. We took that same material and put it into this form, and now we have learning centers which we set up around the country for our managers, and they go there at their convenience. And they will walk in, check in, get a little orientation, and the first thing they do is get something written or go to the computer, and the computer will test them out to see what they know and what they don't and steer them into the areas that they need education in. And the first thing they may do is go pick up a video cassette and sit down and watch a video thing, and then they might take a test to see if they learned it. Then they pre-test the next section. If they pass the test, they don't have to go through it. They don't have to waste their time as they would have in the lecture. Situation. And then they may go at the computer and do a simulation. And it's all mixed to get the most out of the educational methods and the most out of the individual's needs. And I guess that's about, I've done some research on that. It's about the best research or the most comprehensive information that I've seen, because we've really worked hard to find out how it works. We've discovered that our students get through the same material in less time on the average. They get through more material in less time, and they learn about 20% more. The content learning is 20% more. And the cost, this is very important in education, is half of what it was before. And so we've had some spectacular results with that. Larry?
Is the work that you have done, the programs that you've developed, only for company executives, or are you into secondary education?
We haven't gotten into that. I'm just getting into that, and I'll describe that a little bit.
That's teachers expendable?
No, not really. Not yet, anyway. The Carnegie Foundation report was looking at that very seriously and thought it might, and I think some of them even hoped it would. But right as of now, they think that the state of the art is such that it will only augment the teaching. It may be such that they won't have to fill attrition. And in some areas, it may replace teachers. It has an industry. But in an industry, the cost of education is so doggone high. Those areas where the cost is very high, that's where these kinds of things can be applied best. In fact, the costs of education are rising, as I showed you. There's another way of looking at that. Done some careful projections of the cost of computer-based education opposed to traditional, as we call it today. Here's 75 and 85 again, and this is maybe a cost per hour of student delivery time, and the cost somewhere is about $8, something like that, for computer-based education, and somewhere down around two and a half or three for elementary or secondary. And those costs are going like this. Next 10 years, and the cost of computer-based is going down like this, and not down to zero, but it'll be down about 50 cents an hour in about 1985. That's the way the projections look. Now that's all nice background again, but the fun stuff is what these new devices have can do. Have any of you seen a terminal called Plato? Ever heard about it? Plato?
Okay.
P-L-A-T-O. It was developed at the University of Illinois. The National Science Foundation, University of Illinois, and Control Data put together a project about 12 years ago to try to develop the ideal learning environment and with computers and the ideal equipment. And they've gone through four generations and are now building the fifth generations of these devices. The devices, the systems, and all the things that go with it. What we're trying to do, and what the National Science Foundation wanted to do, was find out if computers can really successfully be used in education at all levels, and if so, how would it be used? They've got a couple people down at the university, and they picked Illinois because they had a couple Thomas Edison type guys that really invented some fantastic gear, and they're still at it. I think they're just hitting their stride. But best way to describe it is that a person, any one of you, could interrelate with the computer immediately. You don't have to learn any language. You can sit down and you can start writing course material right away. And with two or three days of a little short course that we have on how to actually be an author, you can just take off. And so one of the biggest breakthroughs is that it doesn't take any kind of training now to write a language that will manipulate the computer in huge ways, which used to take just hours and hours of programming. You can do it in 2 minutes now, or a minute, or a second. The device that they wanted to interact with the student was a device that, first of all, would have great graphic capability, something that could draw pictures, could do almost anything that you'd want in two-dimensional space, and turn things upside down, and just anything you want. And one of the best lessons, or best indications of this, is a lesson they have called the rose, where you pick a mathematical formula that will draw a picture of a flower, and it'll start drawing this thing. And it'll look bigger, and it'll show variations of it, and it's one of the rich camera grew bananas if you saw this thing. It's just really great. Then it had to have rear screen color capability to be able to project things on the back of the screen. And so they have that now. They have it in microfiche, and I just picked up a 35 millimeter projection type of device. So you have a screen that's about that big, and it can write, and it can write either way. It writes in Hebrew, and it writes, we have an Iranian project where they speak Farsi, and that's scribbled backwards. And you can just write anything on it, and you can project stuff from behind. Then they wanted a capability to be able to speak to the student, and they've just finished developing that. They've had a lot of prototype models that we've tested, and now they have a production model that's fully field tested, and it works all the time. It doesn't make any mistakes, and it will talk to you. So the machine talks to the student. It has a big disk about this big. It's a floppy disk, and the computer, or the terminal, has a capability of finding any spot in that disk within 1/5 of a second, something like that. So if you're a child and you're looking at the screen and there's a picture of a frog, and you touch the frog, the machine will say frog. You know, that kind of stuff. Or if you're a student of veterinary medicine, at the University of Illinois, and you want to do some stethoscopic practices to see if what it sounds like and learn how to listen for bad hearts, you can program the machine so a picture of a horse's chest will pop out. You touch the panel and you'll hear the heartbeat that would sound at that point in the horse's chest. And you get the same heartbeat every time, and then if you want to hear what's a faulty aorta like, you plug that into the machine and you listen to it, and you hear a faulty aorta, and you can listen around. You can do that with human anatomy too. Those are some things I've seen. The one thing we haven't developed yet is the voice response, the ability of the terminal to be able to understand the voice. We have that now. The terminals at Illinois and some that I'm building can respond to about 20 to 40 voice commands. You can say, on, and it'll go on. And you can say, go, and it'll do something, or stop, or whatever. So it'll respond to commands. The technology now for that is all done. It's just a matter of getting it into a convenient way of presenting it and making it cheap. So we almost have a robot, I guess. I hadn't thought about it that way till this moment. I guess that's not a good word to use, maybe. The thing can't walk. But like, I suppose they could make it walk if they wanted to. But the next generation of things, I think maybe even the most exciting thing that's going to happen in the next 10 years is an area that they call artificial intelligence, that everybody in the computer business is charging into because they figure the people that get there first are going to have a corner on the market. And artificial intelligence is just simply making the computer smarter. So that if you and I get into a dialogue, you'll ask me a question, and you'll tell me your name, and then you'll tell me something about your background, and start talking about a problem. I can respond to that problem individually, and give you very specific answers to your needs. Well, some people have got programs now on computers that can pretty much do that. It's just a matter of making them smart enough to be able to recognize individual needs and respond to them better, and also to learn faster. Right now, if you want to write a course on a computer, you have to spend quite a bit of time putting the material in. But the big push, I think, in the next decade is going to be getting the stuff into the computer easier, so that a person who is a good teacher and really wants to program the stuff in doesn't have to work so hard. It's still pretty hard, even though it's not like programming a computer. So the devices that are coming along are really, really about to break through and be some phenomenal things. Now, the unfortunate thing, apparently, from what I get as I talk to a lot of educators, is this new technology that is finally the result of about 15 or 20 years of research is based on top of a whole series of big fat flops that industry has made with schools and school teachers. And so generally, when you talk about the use of computers and other technology, television, in classrooms, people just kind of hold their nose and say, I don't want another page turner, or the last thing I had was just terrible. And usually they're talking about some rather unimaginative system that was pretty advanced at the time, but didn't really have any new technology in it. And we're about to break forward with some very exciting new technology. It's such a mind-boggling thing that it's really hard to know where it's going to go. This Carnegie Commission report, which if we have some time, maybe we can get into. No, we don't have much time, do we? Wow, time is just going away. There's a nice little summary in here. They studied, about a year and a half ago, they studied what they thought the impact of technology would be. And they talked about technology as being TV and computers and video cassettes, audio cassettes, and things like that. And, let's see, what else? Some other things, I guess. Communication satellites. What's that going to be in education? And they came to the conclusion, I'll very briefly give you that, is that it's here to stay, and it's going to make just a phenomenal change in the whole business of education at every level, from higher to preschool to adult continuing education. And some people have jumped into that and are moving very fastly. In Nebraska, for instance, the state of Nebraska has about the most exciting and far-reaching project for adult continuing education that I've seen. They've already built they use their statewide television network. So that anybody living anywhere in Nebraska, practically, that has a television set can take a course in accounting and psychology right now for credit, and they don't have to leave home. In the morning paper or the evening paper the night before the class is given, they have the text, and you read that, and you get a cassette that's sent to you in the mail, and then you watch the instructor on TV, broadcasting out of Lincoln. They have a big studio in Lincoln. Just super amount of money poured into that. And the Office of Education and National Science Foundation have put a lot in there. we're working closely with them because we think the next step then is computer-based education. And they've got the lines laid out, and that's the most expensive part, is laying out the communications lines. Now there are, I think, 8 states that have combined with Nebraska called the University of Mid-America, and they're all going to do this. And it's Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, Oklahoma, Iowa, I think, and they're all going to develop curriculum and trade it back and forth. They're all going to use it. So within about 5 or 6 years, there are going to be just an amazing number of courses available to adults. The only problem with that is that in continuing education, there are 3 words that govern it. One is, it allows a student to go at his or her own pace and at the time that the student desires, and that's the tough part, and at the place they desire. Okay, now the place is pretty neat because if you can do it at home, that's what most people want to do according to surveys. But the Mid-America system is still tied to a time. You've got to be at the TV set at just the right time. But the devices that are coming along in the next few years, that there are some things on the drawing board, and I've got a prototype model that our engineers have built. It looks like a briefcase, and you can carry it with you anywhere, and you can plug it into a phone line. You have to have a special jack at home, but you know, if as the price comes down, most of us will probably have these things. But the devices that are coming along in the next few years, that there are some things on the drawing board, and I've got a prototype model that our engineers have built. It looks like a briefcase, and you can carry it with you anywhere, and you can plug it into a phone line. You have to have a special jack at home, but you know, if as the price comes down, most of us will probably have these things. Maybe 1990, maybe all of us won't have, some of us may not be here, but at least it's going to be available for our grandchildren. And it'll be the kind of thing that they can carry with them and open up, and it will be able to talk and listen and access a library bank, and it'll sit down and figure out what it is you need. You know, most people, when they're coming into the world of work, for instance, they don't really know what they want. So you may go through a long diagnostic process, figuring out, asking questions, and you know, what are you interested in, and what do you want to do, or now that you're 40 years old and you've had all your kids, you know, and you start a little counseling session. There are programs like that right now. At Illinois, they have a counseling program like that on the computer, and you come in and you meet a nice, warm, fuzzy person, and they introduce you to the computer and teach you how to use it, and pretty soon you're going into a counseling session, figuring out what it is you like to do and what turns you off, and getting some of the goals that you have that aren't realistic and making them realistic, and then feeding you into some vocational programs if you need it, or helping you find a job. They got a job bank that's continually updated, and the whole thing operates around these terminals. That Illinois has thousands of. They have a, and I guess maybe I should talk a little bit about how these things can work and why they're so cheap. The terminals themselves are rather expensive, but the costs are coming down. I think that they maybe cost $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 to make now. And as they get more expensive, the costs are going to come down. They'll be down by 1980 to somewhere in the range of $2,500. And in fact, there are many people, not many, but there are some that are buying them now for their children. People in Florida have them. I know that we have a computer down in Florida that does this, and people at Illinois, a lot of the professors have them, and they're ready to fork out $5,000 or $6,000 to buy them right now. So when they get down in the range, when the cost comes down like they have with the hand calculators, and the projections are to do that, they may be $1,000 by 1985 or less. Don't know. There's some breakthroughs that have to be made, particularly by the Japanese. And if we can get some mass production that the Chinese offer, and they really are serious about that, we're negotiating with them now to do some mass producing for us, we may really get them down to very, very inexpensive things. So these terminals will do all kinds of phenomenal things, but the real problem then becomes one of communications. How do you how do you get that information out of that terminal? That's really expensive. Right now, if we had one, if we had a phone line into the village and I had a terminal here, I could dial up the University of Illinois or Control Data's computer in Minneapolis or one in Florida or one in Baltimore, and we could start playing with it, and you could start taking courses on astronomy or, you know, almost anything you want. Music, higher education is really on there. They've got, Illinois has 5,000 lessons in higher ed on there in about 200 areas. And you could play with that thing for 4 days and you never even begin to fathom what's in there. But that cost of that phone line would be very expensive. So now we're beginning to play with satellites. We're bouncing signals off of satellites. But we're finding that we're on the wrong planet. The speed of light is too slow, and it takes too long for the signal to get up 25,000 miles and back down again. Human beings are very impatient. When they're sitting there looking at that screen and they touch it and they want something to happen, they don't want to wait for 2 seconds. It just drives them crazy, and they just can't. At first they say, yeah, I don't mind, I'll wait. But when they get into it, they want that answer, and they just got to have it. And so the whole thing has been around getting a very quick response time. And I'm not sure how we're going to solve that. Microwaves, maybe. We're looking at microwaves. And that's a pretty promising thing. But when you start trying to pick up something from Russia and use it in the United States, that doesn't work. Microwave doesn't work. I picked Russia because that's a very practical example. We've just negotiated a deal with Russia where we're setting up their first big computer-based system in Moscow. We're opening up an office there. We're delivering a computer and about 1,000 terminals, 600 maybe, just like the University of Illinois has, and just like we have in Minneapolis, and like Florida State University has. And they're going to begin writing courseware or educational material in English. And one of the advantages that the engineers tell me of dealing with the Russians is that they have much better technical competence in certain areas than we have in the Western world. And so we're trading with them. We're giving them a little bit of a break on the computer if they'll give us the materials that they write, and we can take them back into the Western world and sell them here and use them here. It's kind of a detente thing. That's one of the major objectives of all this stuff, I think, is detente. And it works very well, I think. And so the Russians have some things that we'd like to get. We have some things. We have some things that they want. So we're trading stuff back and forth. Another example of that is in the state of Minnesota. After we finished that study, the next step was to figure out what can technology do to help solve the problems. And the biggest problem we had was price. Getting enough money to fund the writing of the courseware. It's very expensive right now. But we happened to be talking to Venezuela, which has all kinds of oil money, and they don't have any educational system. They really have none at all for the peasants. You know, very small number of people in Venezuela get educated. But the elite in Venezuela is educated. The guys that run communications and education are absolutely dedicated to a revolution in education, because they know if they don't, they're going to have another kind of revolution to toss them out of office, and so they're going to go roaring into this thing as fast as they can. And they have nothing holding them back. They don't have any teachers' unions, they don't have any school boards, they don't have any state legislators, they don't have anything to hold them back. One guy makes all the decisions, and he's got all kinds of money. So what we're trying to work out is a deal where they would pay Minnesota or Iowa or somebody, some state that's interested, to write the courseware, write the materials they use now into the computer, and then let the Venezuelans pick them up and use them. And then they want to take that and bring it all to the rest of Latin America. And that's very close. I think that's very close to fruition. I think that's going to happen. And so the cost, though, will still be very expensive, and we'll have to keep experimenting. All of this stuff is in the research and development stage yet, as far as I'm concerned, because it's not all proven itself, and we've really got to get the cost down. But there's no doubt about it that the stuff is here to stay. And for the teachers in the room, it's not going to wipe anybody out. In fact, this report has just reams of material on what's going to happen to teachers. And everything I read is it's going to be just a lot more fun. Just going to be a lot more fun. You're going to have all the stuff that's not any fun to do will be taken away, and you get all kinds of extra information about the kids. And instead of taking care of 30, you can run 100 kids through the system and do a heck of a lot better job, and all those kinds of things. Those are sort of wild ideas. But they are working now. Those things are. That's not just an idea. It's an actual practicality. We run into some problems with parents. At Illinois, when they first introduced the system with the terminals into the classroom, they brought the parents in because they wanted them to understand what was going on. Well, the parents started playing with the computers and they wouldn't let the kids near them. And so they had to throw the parents out and then give them a special evening once a week where they could come in and play with the thing. And now they've got them all hooked into the courses and they're taking them. There's so many things to talk about. I don't know where to begin. Maybe I should stop. We only have about 10 minutes left and let you ask some questions because I've been rambling. Have any questions? Yes, sir, Larry.
In educational systems, has there been a drop-off in the use of the television set in the classroom?
I think so, personally.
We're experiencing in South Dakota.
Yes.
We're complaining about the cost because the teachers aren't, you know, we make it available and the teachers aren't using it, and we're saying why we don't.
The biggest failure in education in the last 10 years has been the whole business of television. That's what everybody says.
Okay, well, is there somebody here that knows why?
Well, I've read a lot of information and studies on it, and it's mainly because of the way it was introduced. It was introduced as a threat to teachers. The material on it wasn't very good at first. It doesn't have the flexibility that it could have, and does have. It isn't being used properly. My boss says that's the only 5% of all the instructional time in the elementary secondary schools is devoted to anything other than instructional material. I mean traditional tutorial or lecture. Or at least, I'm trying to remember that number. 5% is right, but I think 5% is multimedia. By all the theory and everything else that everybody thought, it would be somewhere up around 25 or 30%. And so for whatever reasons, it's really been a failure. I keep hearing teacher resistance a lot in there, but that may not be the only thing. And I'm not an expert on that at all. That is, I think teacher resistance is going to be the biggest factor in all of this. One of the biggest. Cost is terrible. But if we had everything else solved, unless the teacher understands what's going on, there's no reason why she should or he should accept it.
Well, could it be that in any program where there are two elements, one has to complement the other?
Yes.
And in this case, teacher's teaching a course, and then when you go up and turn on the TV set, and it's projected, right. And there isn't the teacher maybe needed to see the thing ahead of time and either build to that or build around what they see on the TV.
That's it. It's the management, the teacher's ability to manage the situation that they're in. And nowadays there just aren't good tools to do that. I think once this computer managed instruction business hits the schools, and it's just beginning to, and when you experience it, it's just mind-blowing because it opens up so many things, so much more creativity, because you get at the problems that the kids are having. You don't lose them. Or if, you know, instead of having to deal, you can only deal with just a few kids. You know, there's only so much you can do. But if you can concentrate on those that are having the biggest problems or those that are having the problems that you do work with best, you know, that I think that's going to do it. That's probably it. It's how to use it. That television came in and it was just used for canned things, and the material really hasn't been very good. It wasn't what they call validated material. I think that the industry failed miserably because they ran out and did all kinds of neat things that they thought would work, but they never checked it out. And so now there's a whole new breed of cat like myself who doesn't want to go do anything until we've really checked it out. Because if the industry makes a mistake again, it's going to screw things up for another 10 years at least. I keep saying industry. This report and many others that I've read indicate that the resources needed to really bring off a revolution in education again, to solve our quality and our content and our accountability problems, are more than any one segment of our society has. You know, so the government has to bear part of it, industry has to bear part of it, and the education, of course, has to take the lead and make sure that it all goes well. And so they're proposing consortiums of educators, and industry, and government. And that's exactly what I'm finding works best. I'm involved now in about, 10 or 15 consortiums. And they're all that way. The education people are leading it, and when we get into it, there's a lot of training in computer literacy, it's called now, training people to understand what the computer can do, and then usually the federal government is financing it, which is kind of neat, if you can get them to do it. And they're running out of money, though, or at least interest in many areas. But I've got a project, for instance, in learning disabilities, where we're trying to figure out how to how to apply these techniques, these new technology, to the diagnosis and treatment and education of people who have learning disabilities or learning problems. And I ran across them in corrections. That's how I got interested in it. And there's some fantastic stuff going on. In fact, I've got a project right now where someone who's been very successful in doing this in a large system is working with our engineers and our educators and working with some kids through the summer trying to write their materials into the computer or figure out how to do it best. And I'm funding it right now out of our own corporate social responsibility funding, but the HEW is picking it up. State of Minnesota is going to pick it up, and pretty soon they'll make it go. But the educator leads, and wow, they were the people involved in this one were really leery of that computer. They just backed into that one all the way, and they checked it out very carefully before they even began to work with it. And they've got a concept called team teaching, where the teacher and the terminal teach together as a team, and that broke down all the barriers, and in fact it began to be fun. And then they started demanding things that we can't do. They said, well, since you can do this much, let's do some more. And you know, a lot of kids with learning disabilities like to feel things. They learn better tactfully. So they figured, well, as long as you can print things on that screen, let the kid make a letter with his fingers and feel it and make the surface of the screen rough like sand. And then let the computer figure out if he made a correct letter. If he drew an R, then the thing would say R to the kid. And it would flash it up on the screen, bells and whistles. And they were just driving our engineers crazy. But they're trying to do it. They're trying to see if they can. So, you know, immediately when a teacher, an educator gets involved and understands what's going on, then they start pushing the technology harder. They want more. We've gone this far, let's go some more. Yes, ma'am.
It seems to me that the problem maybe has been, or at least this is my understanding, and it will probably show my lack of understanding of the situation, is that technology can do such a fantastic service in so many different ways, but there are things that it just can't do. I mean, sometimes maybe we expect it to do everything.
Yes.
For example, you're given the technology and the teacher doesn't know how to implement or how to use it. And it can do many things in teaching skills and rote-type learning. But to me, it's one of the biggest goals of education is things that can't be taught by rote, like creative solutions to problems that we don't even have yet. This is a really important
thing. That's what it does best in many ways, simulations and things. But there are a lot of experiential things it can't do, you know, group types of things.
I'm just thinking teaching people how to think or attitudes and things.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
how to formulate
some good stuff
the right.
Like
and I don't mean moral. Well, maybe it does.
Yeah,
some
of the most interesting things being done are moral. What is that stuff, Ann? That stuff.
Value
that, yeah, cognitive restructuring and value systems and helping kids experiment with it without having to, you know, face group pressures at first and then weave themselves into the group. Fascinating stuff. Simulations are really neat because, for instance, we teach all of our people when they become managers how to budget. And they get into a very time-pressured situation. They have to go search for information. And the computer becomes their boss, and they ask the boss for information, and he wants to go on vacation, so he leaves them there and says, you ask so-and-so. So he goes ask him, and he has to make decisions about where to get information. It's very realistic. And as he's doing this, time is ticking off in the corner of the screen. The clock is running, and he has to have this done in 24 hours of working time. And it's set up so that the guy gets into a bind and can't really make it, so he has to make some quick decisions and throws the numbers into the budget. And then the computer analyzes it and comes back and tells them what he did wrong. Now, we've always been able to show people how to work through a budget, but we've never been able to compress the time element into it. And so then they go through it again and again until they learn how to do it. Now we've found that the students that have gone through that, when they have to actually prepare a budget, they come back and use the whole system to help prepare their own budget, because that'll allow them to try something out. And they won't have to do a lot of manual calculations or program the computer to it. They can just go zip like that.
But
that doesn't work. They back off and they do it again.
Maybe it's my lack of understanding of the situation, but is it true that a computer can only teach you something that somebody already has the answer to?
I think so. I'm not so sure about that. The artificial intelligence stuff is getting pretty flaky in that area. They're beginning to figure things out.
Okay, what I'm trying to say is
that find new information.
Yeah, part of education has to be to help a person learn how to handle things that nobody at this particular point,
yeah.
You know, at say 10 or 15 or 20 years, our students are going to have problems to face that we don't even know the problem in the first place.
Right.
And so we have to try to teach them attitudes or process or something that can handle these problems.
There's an awful lot of can't do, right? There's no doubt about it. And until they get to be as smart as people are and can move around and things, and that's going to be, who knows, if ever.
So that's what I was just trying to say, is that they have to work together and that there are certain areas that,
But they make a nice adjunct, and that's, and those are the things that teachers do best, the kinds of things you're talking about, I think. We've had a lot of teachers in and asked them about this. How do you feel? And they almost do the person, they say, yeah, I like to do the things that thing can't do, and I don't like to do the things that thing can't do. And it does help me manage the whole process.
Maybe teachers realize that
they Well, the biggest problem the Carnegie Foundation report said is teaching educators about the technology. That's going to be the biggest hang-up. Not that they are resisting it or will, it's that nobody understands it. It's like in this room, nobody had heard of this thing called Plato. And before that happens and people understand what it does, it's just not going to work. Someone's going to come in and say, hey, we're going to do something in your school, and they're saying, wait a minute, I don't, change is good sometimes, but let's take a good hard look at it. Well, it's 4:00 and we've got another session coming up, so thank you.